So the thing is that I think we've kind of, so much has happened since Sepp arrived, since the last podcast that I recorded. So, I mean, you know, we had the talent night, and then everybody graduated. Then we had the, Sepp arrived, and then it's like, man, it's just been nonstop crazy ever since.
Right. A lot of great info.
Well, yeah, there's been a ton of great info, but it's like, okay, so he's doing public stuff about 7 hours a day, and then for a lot of times at lunchtime, he takes a two-hour lunch break, and then at least one of those times, I think twice, I've been hauled off, like, Sepp wants you to come have lunch with him. And then for dinners, it's like, last night was the first night I got a break.
Right.
And Sepp has things he wants you to come to dinner and talk to him about these things. One time we had dinner at your house.
Yeah, it's been really exciting, but it hasn't left a lot of time to record podcasts, I guess.
Yeah, it's been utterly insane. Sepp wants me to get a passport and travel the world with him.
Go to Russia.
Yeah, the Russia thing. Wow. And it's like, he's got so much to convey to me. It's like, he says, I didn't even know what he wanted me to do in Russia until the middle of one of the presentations, I think it was yesterday,
right.
He started to outline what's going on in Russia.
Right, and you know, even that was just kind of a surface layer flyby. It wasn't in too much detail, but I thought the thing that was also neat was a dinner, you know, over a glass of wine. You got to expose him to some of the things that he never wasn't familiar with, like the Wafadi and especially the rocket mass heaters.
Well, I don't think I've told him anything about Wafadi yet.
But I thought you mentioned that to him. Okay.
Yeah, no, the rocket mass heater. And that's the other thing, too, is everything you want to try, whenever you want to try and communicate, everything takes twice as long.
Right.
Because you have to have the translator.
And one of our translators was actually making a delicious Austrian dinner. We were one down. And the other one was just, we didn't want to bother him too much because he's been translating all day. The poor guy's probably, and he's doing a fantastic job. I probably just want to enjoy a glass of wine and not have to talk for a while. But nevertheless, he was very gracious and we got a lot of information conveyed. And I know you had a chance to show him pictures from the website, too.
And then when I'm not with Sepp, then it seems like everybody wants to shake my hand and ask me questions. And last night, I finally died. I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I ran away, got a milkshake, a huckleberry milkshake, which was awesome.
That's right, Montana specialty.
The Montana thing. Everything's huckleberry here.
All about huckleberries, baby.
Yeah. So, all right. We're taking a 20-minute break, and it's like, okay, let's try and see if we can squeeze in some of these things that are so much stuff. It came up, greenhouses came up. I wrote some notes down. Sepp does use his greenhouses for more than raising worms.
Right.
He also raises beneficial insects.
That's right. And I think he brought up some really interesting points about successive adaptation. And when you asked him that question about, I think you told your podcast listeners in the past that he only sows seeds outdoors, which was true, but he also mentioned that he does experiment with some stuff and growing things inside, but there's certain rules that he follows and the way he plants it.
I tried to ask him the question, this is what I've told people in the past, is it true? And then he has like this 20-minute long answer, and it's like so vague and complicated. I'm constantly experimenting.
Right.
That I finally had to say, okay, you know what? Let me ask this question a simpler way. I've been telling people that what Sepp Holzer does is he prefers that the tomatoes plant themselves, that they basically volunteers.
Right.
And that if he can't do that, he will direct seed next. And the thing that he avoids doing is transplanting. And is that correct? For just tomatoes. Let's just like limit it to tomatoes so we can get a clear answer.
Right.
And he said, yes, that is accurate.
Right.
Oh, for crying out loud. Good. So for a while there, I was getting a little worried. Like, I've been telling people the wrong thing.
Right. But then he added that little caveat that he has experimented with doing plants, growing them in the greenhouse, but if you plant them right outside immediately, they'll get shocked and they'll die.
He talked at great length about why starting stuff in a greenhouse sucks.
Right.
But at the same time, he's experimented to find with, and I like the thing that he said about what he does is that he tries a lot of different things.
Right.
And then he finds out what nature likes best.
Exactly.
And then he wants to do that which nature likes best. And yesterday I was trying to play a little bit of a diplomat between some of the parties involved, and I was trying to explain that Sepp Holzer has a deep romance with nature, and it is Sepp and nature that create these great symphonies in seed and soil out of their romance.
And that's a great way to say it. It is like a symphony, you know, just like in an orchestra. You got so many, you know, 100 players that all come together playing different instruments. It's very analogous to this type of permaculture.
And I don't think, I was thinking about the analogy of like Sepp is the violin player and the nature is the violin, but I don't think that's appropriate. I think they're equals and they're symbiotic, and that, you know, one it does require, in order to see the things that we see Sepp create, it does require both of them, and they are, I do kind of like the idea, it does seem to work, that they are both in love. And in fact, one of the things that he said was something like, somebody asked the question yesterday about what kind of liner do you use in a pond, and Sepp said, I hereby grade your question with an F, the lowest grade possible. And one of the things that he said that I thought was, the water needs to be connected with the earth.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, I mean, does that not show passion for nature to say that it's like, no, you know, it's like I could see Sepp saying we're going to use a plastic pipe or something like that here and there, mm-hmm, to make the best of this, but you know, and then somebody else asked a question like, what kind of pipe would you use to get the water to go from a higher pond to a lower pond? And Sepp was very adamant that you do not use a pipe. There's no, you know, and it's like, yeah, I think it comes back to that thing about you need the water to be in contact with the earth. That's a very critical thing, and he talked about that a lot. It's like, how do you improve the soil if it's in a pipe? You can't improve, how do you improve the water if it's in a pipe?
Right, it seems like, you know, in fact, going back to that musical analogy, I would almost say maybe the tomato plants are the violin, and the cellists are the cucumbers, and stuff like the conductor, the composer, in a sense, and he kind of brings them all together in a nice symphony, but they're symbiotic. They need him, and he needs them. Nature may be left to itself without, you know, some direction, may not sound too good, just like an orchestra, but at the same time, the conductor is worthless without the player. So I think, you know, he brought up a lot of interesting points about on the rare occasions where he has experimented with growing something in a greenhouse or starting it in a greenhouse, because his growing season is so short in Austria, he does a successive adaptation technique where he'll start to leave a window open so the greenhouse is a little colder. Then he'll open a window and a door, and he'll gradually kind of bring the plant along. And then when he plants it outside, he'll actually plant it on the shaded side of the hugelkultur bed so it doesn't get morning sun. And I thought that was an interesting point. The reason being is that if the morning sun hits it, it'll warm up too fast. And it's almost like if you freeze a glass of water and put it in the freezer, then immediately take it out and put it in the heat, the glass will explode. But if you put it in the refrigerator, let it slowly defrost, it won't explode.
This is one of his strategies for growing citrus in the Alps as well.
Right.
And I want to emphasize that he was trying to say that some people insist on doing transplants. And so he wanted to convey this information for those people.
Right.
But the thing is that I think that in summary, he's saying transplants are like probably the worst idea, and that really, you know, hopefully you'll evolve to the point that you stop doing that, and instead you either direct seed or allow the plants to reseed themselves.
Right.
Like, so allowing them to reseed themselves is number one.
And it's work, yeah. More natural, the seed gets to get established.
Higher success rate. I mean, he talked at great length about the much higher success rate of those plants.
Exactly. And it's a lot less work, because when he used the analogy for the sake of those people that do some transplanting, when he was emphasizing, you know, how it would, you have the best chance of that being successful, he talked about how you have to do the successive adaptation from the greenhouse, let it get colder, but then you got to mulch the heck out of it too, so it has almost like a blanket over it. It's just a lot more work.
So here's a thing that he said that was really new to me, very profound. I would say it's bullshit, except that it came from Sepp. And so therefore I therefore believe it until somebody can prove otherwise, which normally is not something I would do, but this is Seth, and it's like I'm perpetually feeling humbled by the things that he says. It's so profound. There's so much massively advanced stuff which becomes totally obvious the moment he says it.
There really is.
But this one's one where I'm taking it on faith, and it is that people experience allergies only from those plants that have been treated with chemicals or in some kind of artificial stress.
Right.
And that when they aren't treated with chemicals or they are not under some sort of artificial stress, it sounds like the allergies go away, which I think is rather fascinating.
It's very fascinating. It just shows there's a lot of things we do when you use a lot of chemicals and unnatural type processes. We don't know all the ripple effects of that and what problems we may be causing. And that was a really interesting example because that was a family he worked with, which I think this story is chronicled in his new book, which actually hasn't been translated yet to English, but it will be. But it was a family from Vienna that lived in the city, and they basically ended up moving to the country, building a farm, and using Sepp as a consultant. It was really interesting how the wife had allergies her whole life, and not only to the plants, but to bees as well. And the doctor who had treated her, when she said she no longer had allergies anymore, he said that allergies usually come from plants, which have been stressed by chemicals. And if the plants have not been stressed by chemicals, they generally won't produce allergens. And so that was a very, and I think even to Sepp at that time, that was kind of a revelation. But very interesting point. And he also made the point that she would eat nettles as a counter poison.
That was weird.
He didn't go much into that, but he just kind of touched on it. That was interesting, too.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of nettles being consumed that way. That is fascinating. I want to go look that up, and I'm sure there'll be a wealth of information there. Something I don't have written down here to talk about, but is something I want to point out before I forget, and that is that on the first night Seth had me over for dinner, it was obvious that he wanted me to just, cork my pie hole and listen, and I just got this deluge of stuff, and he pulled out all these pictures of the projects that he's been working on since the last time I saw him. What an array of amazing stuff. Now, he told me that he's going to be showing them here in the classroom, so I asked him to, wait to give me the full descriptions, because it was getting so late at night, and I was so
beat.
I mean, we've been doing this PDC, nonstop.
Yeah, they're long days.
And so it's like,
fun.
But I'm telling you, there is some very, he's been working on a lot of greening the desert type projects, even beyond Spain and beyond Portugal. There's been so much stuff he's been on massive scale.
Yeah.
And like this thing in Russia that he wants me to get involved with, it sounds like it's something like 30,000 acres. It's just such a huge scale, and it's like utter wasteland.
Right.
And he wants to turn it into a jungle utopia and populate it with thousands of people.
Yeah.
And it's just like there's nothing there now, and it's like I'm flabbergasted at the idea, and he shared some details, but I'm still I believe he can do it, earlier today Emo was telling me Emo was saying, I don't know if I want to go because I know what's going to happen. You're going to get there and you're talking about the living conditions while you're doing it,
pretty rough,
will be a little less than rough, a little poorer than rough. And it's Siberia, and so it's like a tent might look like a good thing.
Right, it's some rough country.
Wouldn't a tent be nice here? Yeah.
And also I think just the machinery they use is not always reliable.
That's right.
Excavators and earth movers.
He was kind of explaining what the earth movers are like.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's like a big bucket you drag on the ground with a tractor. It's like, really?
Yeah. It's interesting stuff, though. On the other hand, it would be quite an experience, and it seems like there's a lot of, Russian people that are very interested in this kind of thing and trying to get away from some of the cities and the overcrowding and, stake a claim, so to speak. So,
all right. The next note that I have here, and I'm moving along quickly because the break is short.
Yeah.
The next is that hugelkultur repairs acidic soil.
Yeah, there was a whole volume of information on hugelkultur. he went into, and it almost seems like hookah culture is almost a one-stop fix for just about any kind of soil problem. But the other details that I thought were interesting and were new to me was he plants certain plants at certain points in hookah culture. Those that need more moisture, you plant towards the bottom of the bed. Those that can handle a lot less water, you plant on top, like medicinal herbs and those kinds of things. And even the direction you plant them as far as which plants are more sensitive to morning sun and those things. So that was a whole other layer of information I thought was really fascinating.
So while we're here at this site, they're already beginning work on some projects here. And one of the things that they've done is they've built a hookah culture bed with a lot of meander to it.
Right.
For good texture. Well, I mean, the one we saw yesterday, I want to talk about the one we saw yesterday. Okay. So they got one, but it was like 300, 400 feet long with meander in it. And I was, and as I saw it, I had a bunch of my pod people come to me and say, you know, what's up with that? Well, shouldn't there be breaks in it? And I said, basically what we have here is that Sepp Holzer is an artist. He's been handed a canvas and he's painting his masterpiece. And according to the wishes of his sponsor, Katarina,
right?
You know, and sponsor's not the right word, but screw it. And if I had been hired, well, I was trying to think of, like, you know, 500 years ago, an artist had a person who, you know, kind of kept them in food,
right,
for their art, kind
right.
of a thing.
Right.
There, I can't remember what the word was. All right, but anyway,
contracts them to paint to create the masterpiece.
Yeah, benefactor.
There you go.
So, and then I am not the artist. I am not the artist that's been hired to work on this piece of work. And yes, I would do it differently. There are things that I would do differently, and as always, if I have a difference of opinion from Sepp, I must be wrong, and I just don't understand how yet. However, Sepp is also one of those people that advocates, you know, be an independent thinker and do what you think is right, and do not think of the things he says as recipes. You know, you must embrace the knowledge and then do what you think is right.
Exactly.
So I would do it different.
Well, he might have just been trying to that meander not only for artistic purposes, but to create more edge, you know, to kind of follow the contour of the wetlands a little bit. So there might have been some of those artistic elements into it. I don't know.
It's not following a contour. It's a meander to help build different kinds of edge. I just would have broken it a bit.
Yeah.
I probably also would have had it go perpendicular to the direction it's going now, so that way it won't get any frost pockets.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think I would also try and shape it in such a way so that it would create some kind of shape, because the woman who is the benefactor, she is seeking something particularly spiritual in that space. I just like the idea of being able to create a shape. I think she would be more pleased if it had some sort of shape that had some meaning to it.
Right.
All right, so.
Of course, we haven't seen the finished project yet either, so maybe, you know, I'm sure there'll be plenty of other adjustments made before it's all said and done.
Another thing he did is he said, do not put hookah culture on terraces. What is the point? You know, you already got the terrace. You're able to reach up onto the steep part of the terrace and harvest from that. Why would you add hookah culture to that? You wouldn't be able to drive your tractor or other vehicle through there, which you may sometimes need, which is one of the advantages of a terrace on something very steep.
Right.
And I always kind of thought the thing to do is build a very wide terrace, and then you have a part where your vehicle can go on, and you put hookah culture on top of that as well.
Which makes sense, and I think some of this may be lost in translation. I think he was just thinking, I think the question related to water issues, and I think he's probably was thinking from a water perspective that a terrace is going to hold water and prevent it from running down the side of the hill, and in the same way a hookah culture bed is going to, you know, wick up water and absorb water in the wood in the middle of it as a storage tank, and so why would you have those redundant things? That might have been where he was going with that, but...
Right. Okay, next up, if you're trying to do a hookah culture bed and you don't have a lot of wood, then his solution is that you just plant a shitload of potatoes, and that the potatoes, you're not gonna be able to ever possibly harvest all of them, but the potatoes will beget more potatoes, which will beget more potatoes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They will effectively become the carbon in your hookah culture bed. bed instead of the wood.
Right.
And I thought that was pretty fucking clever.
I thought, you know, that and the other thing was interesting when you talk about that Catholic order, religious order, invited him down to Columbia to help the kids that are on the street, you know, that are, and how he was actually using some of those techniques around garbage dumps where they didn't have a lot of stuff, but he taught these kids how to make use of what they had, literally using dirt and using, like, leaves and other things that are around the dump as mulch, and even, like, potatoes that, you know, restaurants or hotels have thrown away, and they were cultivating a ton of beautiful potatoes down there just using raw materials around the dump. And somebody brought up the question of, you know, the cleanliness issues of that, and I can't remember off the top of my head what his answer was, but it satisfied me. Apparently, it's potatoes look beautiful, and he said you barely even have to really wash them. You can rinse them. You remember when he said that?
The dump stuff has always kind of bugged me a little bit, but it's like the stuff from 3 years ago, he had all these pictures and stuff, and it's like, here's like 50 kids, 50 children who effectively live parentless at a dump,
right.
And they're like, you know, they're finding food in the dump, they're like, I mean, everything's dump, and so Seth came in,
right.
And he did a bunch of things using materials from the dump to provide these kids with fresh food, so that way they could have, you know, it's like
they wouldn't starve to death.
Yeah, it's like, okay, these kids, I mean, this is the way society is kind of fucked up, but he's going to try and help them have it be a little bit better.
Right.
And so he put some things in so that they would have, like, some fresh fruits and vegetables, and they're going to continue to live at the dump. You're not going to get them to leave there. There's no place else for them to go, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And I think he was also, though, trying to teach them not only to, you know, have a better quality of diet and be more self-sufficient and raise their own food, but from free materials around the dump or things you can get for free, but also, you know, being able to have those kids teach them how to be instructors in the future, so that as they grow up, they might have a better future. And that was a really, you know, a real, I don't know, tearjerker almost kind of project. He's doing a lot of good for a lot of those kids in those slum areas, helping them survive and hopefully have a better future by giving them skills and knowledge to teach other people how to do this kind of thing.
Right. He seems to currently have 200 projects worldwide, and a lot of those projects are very much like, these people here have they've been given the short end of the stick. They've been really screwed. You know, somebody has fucked over these people, and he comes in and will do things to make it so that their lives are much easier. So when we talk about how Seth is a powerful advocate of people making money, I think we should also keep in mind that a lot of his projects are for really helping people that are in real trouble.
Yeah, very altruistic, you know, all around the world. Even a lot of the Russia stuff, it sounded like a lot of those people were really poor people living in the country, and he's got a strong altruistic
speech. The Russian thing seems to start with the idea of you have no money, you have no job, you have nothing.
Right.
You know, you have the clothes that you're wearing, and that's it. And
right.
So, like, can we do something if we give this person a hectare of land and a shovel?
Yes.
We give them that. What can they build? What can they create?
Yeah, in fact, that was the latter part of the seminar yesterday. I'd say probably the last half hour to an hour, that was what we talked about. What would you do if you had absolutely nothing but the clothes on your back? No tools, no money, no nothing. How could you survive? And he went into great, we don't have time on this podcast probably to go through that, but maybe that'll be a future podcast, but it was a lot of detailed information as to how you could literally create a life for yourself, shelter, although the shelter thing, I think,
shelter,
wasn't
food,
completely
just,
but
seeds would be thrown in there somewhere.
Seeds, and then the crater garden thing and all that kind of stuff, protection from the elements, but that was quite an interesting thing as well.
So I imagine that this is probably a question that comes up for a lot of people in Russia that we're not currently aware of, and so very fascinating.
Yes.
Another thing is that when we had dinner over at your house the other night, then I drove Seth and Judith back to where the event's going on.
Yeah.
And then on the way back, then Seth was pointing at all the trees, or so driving by this forested area, we're at Flathead Lake.
Right.
We're all these trees, all this forest, and Seth points up and he says, all of those trees are sick. All of them.
Yeah.
Every last one. There's not a tree out there that's not sick.
And that
what is wrong here?
Yeah, they've had a beetle, no problem in some of the areas, and I think they're you know, obviously the forestry people are trying to address it one way, and I think Chef would probably have a difference of opinion.
So,
as to how they
the issue
it.
Was is that the beetles, that's the symptom, that's not the illness. And
right.
So we visited with that for a bit, but the and then we talked about why they're sick and how they got to be that way, things like that. But that's another podcast for another day. The key is that it was obvious to him that they were all sick. All right.
One thing I just want to mention, too, is about how he uses gravel to purify water and also to oxygenate water. And that, at the times you mentioned about pipes early on, well, you know, the occasions when he will use a pipe for a certain specific reason, he makes sure there's a long drop-off so that the water can free fall. So when it hits the water below it, it creates oxygen and generally likes to use gravel and stones.
And it repurifies the water after that trip in the plastic or metal or whatever.
Exactly. He even mentioned there's an old saying, which isn't 100% true, but it's on the right track, and that is that if water flows across three stones, it will be purified again. It's kind of an old saying.
Yeah. I thought that was good. I wrote that one down, too.
Yeah.
Here was an interesting saying that he mentioned yesterday, I believe, and that is that he's currently keeping water buffalo.
Yeah, that blew me away, because I don't know if he's talking about, like, the Cape buffalo in Africa, because I heard those are, like, some of the most dangerous animals on Earth. They're just really ornery, and then they'll, you know, gore you in a New York second. But it sounds like he is. Maybe it's a different species, but very interesting. I mean, I know here in Montana, buffalo and bison meat is a kind of something they specialize in, a really high-quality, high-protein, low-fat, healthy type of meat, healthier type of meat, and then a lot of stuff you get in a typical, you know, slaughterhouse. So that was very interesting, and I know he's kept a lot of exotic animals in the past, like yaks and things like that, but that was a new one for me, too.
Yeah, and then keeping ponds clear of excess plants, which makes you think like a moose.
Exactly. Like that Moose Drool beer they brew in Missoula. You know, got the logo with the foliage coming out of Moose's mouth.
Well, of course, you know, moose, they that's their thing, is ponds and lakes. They love to eat the stuff out of ponds and lakes. So maybe he's kind of doing the European moose kind of approach or something.
It sounded like he was using these animals, grazing them in the ponds, so they would eat the excess vegetation and kind of balance out the system.
Yeah. All right. I think we're probably running out of time. I see that the interpreters are back in the front. I don't see Sepp yet, but we're gonna get back into this. Sepp did mention something about how a lot of people in the permaculture world have given him a lot of grief, and he doesn't have time for it. He's very quick to dismiss it, but he feels that they're like Sepp has talked about how he has talked with Bill Mollison, Jeff Lawton, and David Holmgren, and all three of these guys support his work, and he supports theirs, and all of them use earthworks, and he feels that the reason that people are, like, giving him grief has to do with his use of earth-moving equipment.
Right.
And that he feels like a lot of them are advocates of Dave Holmgren,
right,
and that they come to him and say, you know, no, because you use earth-moving equipment, then, you know, we do not approve of what you call permaculture. We don't, that's not permaculture.
Right.
And so now Sepp feels like he's been validated that by the greats, by the people who made up the word, and so he feels free to use the word permaculture all he wants, and he just kind of dismisses these other people as kind of nutty people. And
yeah, I think the important point he made is that some of these people that had attacked him or had some reservations about some of the things he did, once they visited his farm and they saw it, all those reservations were dismissed. They now totally support him. And I think even, your podcast where you interviewed Jeff Lawton earlier, Jeff Lawton himself said he was absolutely enthralled with what Sepp was doing and just thought it was absolutely brilliant. So, I think a lot of those are maybe just the people on the periphery that maybe don't have the full understanding and scope of the things that Sepp's doing.
And, you know, from all the projects that we've heard about and I've seen pictures of, which are coming up soon, I'm going to speculate that Sepp's doing stuff on far more projects on far larger scale than anybody else in the permaculture world at this time. But maybe it'd be good to like get a good idea of what these things are, and then I should give Jeff a ring and see what he thinks and compare notes.
Certainly, I know there's no one, even a lot of the great stuff that Mollison has done, and Jeff Lawton certainly has done some big projects. But yeah, I think with the size and scope, over 200 projects worldwide, and these tend to be big projects. We're not talking talking a small little backyard garden. We're talking, you know, thousands of hectares. I mean, I think the thing in Russia we talked about, he's got the highest approval from the universities in St. Petersburg and the highest levels of government in Moscow. And we're talking massive tracts of land that they're basically begging him to come in and revitalize. So,
right. And at the same time, he has done a lot with urban stuff. And in fact, here comes Sepp. But as long as we're talking about urban stuff, maybe we could get the attention of Judith and Emo, and or not, and talk to them about. So this is Judith and Emo are two people who have written books on urban permaculture, and they've worked with Sepp. And so Judith, hi, I got your attention.
Hi.
So we're recording a podcast. See the little flashy light?
Yeah.
So then right, and then the idea is that you have a book on urban permaculture.
Yes.
But it's all in German.
Yes. Yeah,
it's been very popular in Germany, I hear.
Yeah, so far in the last short time, we really got a lot of sales for the book.
Yeah, and so now you, how long did you spend working under Sepp?
With Sepp together, we did the education 2 years ago, and since that time we are working together.
Okay. So I wonder if I might be able to sneak in and get Sepp to say something real quick. Maybe no.
I think we should start.
You better start. Yeah. He's starting to look angry already.
Yeah, he is.
He's giving me the stink eye.
Yeah.
So he wants me to sit down and shut up, doesn't he?
It should be the better way.
Okay. All right. And that's it for today.
Take a seat, please.